Channel 4 don't lose anything. Sorry, start again. Channel 5 doesn't lose anything on this. They, you know, they get an audience for it. It's a commercial station. It's driven by advertisers. Advertisers might like this. It's just whether or not
people
watch
it.
It's good enough.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, good to talk to you, Mark. That's Mark Bukowski there, PR consultant. Channel 5 Castaway with Phil Schofield tomorrow.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Justine Green. Israel's most senior general has told troops to be ready for a possible incursion into southern Lebanon to fight Hezbollah. General Hetzi Halevi said airstrikes were degrading Hezbollah forces before ground forces could enter. Speaking ahead of a UN Security Council meeting, President Macron of France has urged de-escalation to avoid a full-scale war. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen is in Jerusalem.
Israel believes that inflicting this pain will force Hezbollah somehow to stop firing into Israel. That is against all the ideology and history of behavior that they've had. I think at a time like this, their instinct will be to keep on firing as long as they can.
President Putin has made a fresh threat about the possible use of nuclear weapons if Russia comes under attack. He warned that aggression by a non-nuclear state that was supported by a nuclear power would be considered a joint attack. Labour has insisted it will stand firm on its cuts to the winter fuel allowance in England and Wales after delegates at the party's conference voted to scrap the policy. Under the plans, the payments of up to £300 will only go to those who receive pension credit or other means-tested benefits. The vote put forward by the Unite Union is non-binding. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting said the government would not be changing course.
The thing about delegates to party conference, whether they're from our constituencies or trade unions, they get the chance to put their points across and they get the chance to speak up in the ways that on the issues that they care about and give us the advice that they think we should follow. But ultimately, it's us, the government, the Parliamentary Labour Party, that don't have the luxury of ducking the difficult choices and decisions.
Rail workers in the RMT union have voted overwhelmingly to accept a pay offer to end their long-running dispute. Workers at Network Rail and at train operating companies will receive an increase of 4.5%. The Transport Secretary Louise Hay said the pay rise would clear the way for vital reform, including modernising working practices. EU member states have approved lowering the protection status of wolves, making it easier to hunt them. The European Commission has said the change is necessary because the number of wolves is increasing, posing a danger to livestock and bringing them into greater contact with humans. Conservation groups have rejected this. But a spokesman for the European Commission, Adelbert Jans, says the move will help protect the wolves.
In the Commission's view, adapting the protection status will be an important step to address the challenges posed by increasing wolf populations, while keeping the overall objective to achieve and maintain a favourable conservation status for the species.
In football, Liverpool came from behind to thrash West Ham 5-1 in the League Cup with two goals each from Diogo Jota and Cody Gakpo. Arsenal won by the same scoreline against Bolton in their third-round tie. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past 11.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Keeping you up to date with everything Formula One.
It has been utter dominance for Lando Norris, who wins the Singapore Grand Prix.
It was an amazing race. A few too many close calls. I'm a bit out of breath, but very fun one.
Next up, Austin, Texas, and an intense six-race sprint to the end of the year.
The Checkered Flag Podcast.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Just gone 3 minutes past 11. Just a heads up, if you are in the north of England and listen to 5 Live on 9:09 a.m, there will be some more essential engineering work tonight on one of our transmitters just after midnight. Again, it's been happening all week. To stay with 5 Live, you can still find us on DAB, digital radio, digital TV and BBC Sounds. So welcome then. It's time for the family group chat. It's Johnny in for Gordon on a Wednesday evening, and it's a pleasure to be here. This is the space that we make each week to talk about family in all its facets. We take a different subject each time and open it up to the group chat. We always like to hear the thoughts and experiences of our late night community too. So if anything really resonates with you, please do get in touch. The number's as usual, 85058 on the text. And you can WhatsApp us on 0808 5909 693. We're going to talk about family businesses tonight. We want to discuss, well, the life of a family business. Talk about families who don't just live together, but work together too. The families who have strived, sometimes for many generations, to make something out of nothing and build a business they can be proud of. The word family business can conjure up all sorts of different images, can't it? From a small family shop to a multi-billion pound global empire like the Roys in the TV series Succession. Hopefully the families that we're going to talk to tonight aren't as dysfunctional as they are. But who knows, as we get into it, maybe it'll be more interesting if they are. And though the Roys are a work of fiction, some of the biggest families are family-owned, like Walmart, the Ford Motor Company in America, or JCB, and Dyson in the UK. Look at what's happening with Rupert Murdoch's empire right now. Here to shed some light on what it's like to run a family business with your nearest and dearest are a few guests I'm really excited to talk to tonight. Welcome to the programme, Di Parhams. In 2019, she and her husband Simon took over the dilapidated Bassenthwaite Lake train station in the Lake District. They've turned it into a cafe and special events venue themed around the Murder on the Orient Express. And Di's going to talk a bit more about that on the programme. Evening to you, Di. How are you?
Good evening. I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Great to have you here. We've also got Sam Walker. Sam runs the Walker and Ling department store in Weston-super-Mare. I know it well. It's where I grew up. Weston-super-Mare, not in the shop, although my mum took me in there plenty of times. The business has been going since 1982. He's the fifth generation of the Walkers to look after it. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Hi, Johnny. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
How's the motherland? Is it all right?
It's very well, thank you.
Good stuff, good. And Neil Davey, the CEO of Family Business UK, a membership organisation that champions the family business sector. How are you, Neil?
Very well, thank you, Johnny.
So we'll get into Di and Sam's business in a moment's time. But Neil, if I could just start with you before we meet our business owners properly. It sounds like a silly question, but is there a specific definition of what makes a family business?
Different people will hold different definitions. I think keeping it simple, the criteria we kind of use is that the family have a minimum of a 25% shareholding of the business.
Right.
Essentially, that is our core. So that's the core criteria.
Right. So, but you don't have to have a specific number of families involved. Presumably, it could just be two people from a family or whatever. It's not just.
Yeah, there's no restriction on that. Basically, if you've got minimum of two people from the family involved, we would say that's a family business. And it might be a first generation family business or it could be a 12th generation family business.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. And something else as well is the level of businesses that are run by families. Read some research from the Family Business Research Foundation that said in 2020 there were 4.8 million family businesses in the UK, which makes up 90% of the UK private sector. Is it really that high?
If you apply that criteria, it is. And there are about 13.9 million people working in family businesses, and that contributes about $200 billion in taxes every year to the Exchequer.
Right, okay. Amazing stuff. And they're obviously an absolutely vital part of the UK economy then.
They are. And I think the way we describe it is essentially they're the backbone to the UK economy. I've been in this role now for a couple of years. And one of the reasons why I was so kind of keen to get involved and really support the sector was I think that the sector is kind of underrepresented and underutilized. And actually that the fact that it contributes so much to our economy and it's so important to our economy, I don't think is fully appreciated. And that was something I was very keen to address.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. Well, listen, stick around because we've got a couple of fantastic businesses. First, let me introduce Di. It seems appropriate to play this. Now, Di, I don't need to tell you that this is the theme tune to the Orient Express. I imagine you've heard this about 1,000 times a day.
I have heard it quite a lot, yes.
just tell me a little bit about your business, because, I was on the website today. I haven't had the pleasure of visiting it, but I love the Lake District. But what a fascinating concept. Tell me about it and where the idea came from.
It had small beginnings, really. We were fortunate to acquire a derelict former station on the Keswick-Cockermouth-Penrith railway line. and rebuilt it from totally derelict, roofless, overgrown and virtually unrecognisable as a station, purely to become a loo and a brew for the adjacent nature reserve. And one thing led to another, and there wasn't quite enough seating to make it a viable business. And Simon and I had this ongoing conversation about who was going to quit their job first. And we had a little bit of a thing where we just agreed it was going to be both of us or neither of us. So we went off to look for a carriage where we could put some extra seating in to make it viable. And we're very fortunate to be offered the... it's not a real train, it's a replica, but it's the film set from the 2017 Murder on the Orient Express film. Amazing. That was directed by Kenneth Branagh.
How did you, I mean, how do you just come by to be offered that? That's quite an unusual thing to come across.
It was quite an unusual situation, and it's the classic all the ducks lined up. We'd had this conversation and my husband decided to go onto eBay and search for train carriages and found just an old decrepit train carriage that was based in a specialist haulage yard down in Stoke. And that day I happened to be working down in Birmingham, and he rang and said, "Di, get off the motorway at Stoke, go and have a look at this thing, see if it's anything like what we could use to pop some tables in." And it wasn't. It was nothing like, it had too much asbestos. It was nothing like a condition that we could have had members of the public in. But the gentleman who owned the yard said, "But we do have this." And it was the salon carriage from the film where they'd sort of conspired. I don't know whether anybody knows the plot, but basically they all conspire, the whole of the passenger conspires to commit this murder. And it was one of the scenes from the film.
Wow.
So we looked at it and had no budget whatsoever in our left over from the restoration of this derelict station. Between Stoke and the Lake District on my journey home, it went from "No, absolutely not, we haven't got the money" to "Actually, it's quite a good idea, this, and it would be cheaper than an extension." Plus an extension in the national park, whilst the national park planners have been exceptionally supportive of our business. Extensions and things like that are notoriously difficult to achieve in a national park setting. Mm. So we asked them instead, "Can we put a train carriage on there?" And then 6 months or so later, while we were prepping up the old railway track and so on, they rang and said, "This oversized train carriage," so it's the correct gauge, but it's oversized in every way, "the person who was buying the rest of the train couldn't get it over to Ireland because it was oversized, and they hadn't realized that a ferry can't take an oversized train, because you can't have a couple of meters of train hanging over the back of an Irish ferry. So would you take it? Can you take it? It'll cost you this." And we said, "Well, we really can't afford five times what we're paying for the other one." So we came to an arrangement. Simon and I had a mighty fine bottle of wine that night, and decided from the very start, absolutely under no circumstances can we possibly afford this. We're 50 years old. This would be absolutely crazy. And it went gradually as we went through the bottle of wine and into, "Well, it would be quite good, wouldn't it?" And then it went into, "Oh, we could do this and we could do that." And it opens up these possibilities. And by the end of it, it was, "We're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do the other." And we actually put our house on the market the following day.
Wow.
To buy a fake train that leaked like a sieve, and just decided, "You live once, let's do it." So
brilliant.
That's exactly how it came up.
I love it. And yet more proof that all the best decisions are made after drinking wine.
Completely.
Let's bring in Sam Walker. Sam is the Walker part of Walker & Ling, the department store, the independent department store in Weston-super-Mare.
Grace Brothers Men's Department.
Mr. Humphreys, are you free?
I'm free.
Forward, please.
I mean, for people of a certain vintage, this will mean a lot. For others, you'll be thinking, what are you being served? Let's bring in the real life Mr. Humphreys, or maybe it's Miss Slocum. Who knows?
Hello, I'm free.
Welcome to the programme, Sam. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Johnny. Have you really been to Walker and Lane?
Yeah, I grew up in Weston-super-Mare. It's my hometown. And it's, you know, it's amazing because the thing is, we all know how difficult it is for high streets at the moment and for independent shops. But to have an independent department store as well, that's something that really should be celebrated. And especially considering the fact that Walker and Ling has a really long and storied history, doesn't it, Sam? Just give us a little potted one, if you will.
Okay. Business started in Bath in 1892, 132 years ago. And the Walker family, the Samuel Walker was the original manager of the store, and went into partnership with Mr. Ling, who was from Devon. And they opened a store in Weston, the up and coming Victorian seaside tourist attraction town, in 1904. At that time it was a sort of drapers, and bespoke clothing, lingerie and linens and overalls and all those sorts of things. And then went through two world wars and successive generations of Walker families. It was extensively bombed in the war, the Western branch. The Bath one closed in 1950, and the Western branch was rebuilt and passed down the generations until it got to me in 2013.
Fantastic.
I've been doing it for...
So how old were you when you took it over?
Sorry?
How old were you when you took it over?
I was 28.
Wow, that's
just
very young.
A new father.
Really? 28?
Actually, my journey had a bit of a similar story as to Di's there, because I was a teacher before, and then my wife said we're having a baby, and I opened a bottle of wine. And then an hour later, I decided that 30 years of decision-making boiled down to one fateful bottle of wine and one decision, and I decided to take up the family business mantle, my destiny.
Well
and
done,
so
you.
For living.
So let's get in then to running a business. And we'll start with you, Sam, because your journey, although similar, is slightly different in the sense that I guess there was always this idea that it could happen and you could take over the family business. But was there pressure? Did you feel a weight of expectation growing up that this one day will be your son and you'll be expected to run the place?
No explicit pressure, of course. Mum and Dad were clear that I could sort of pursue whatever my interests were. And at 18, at 20, I was absolutely sure the one place I wasn't going to live was Weston-super-Mare, and the one thing I wasn't going to do was run the department store. So no pressure. But I suppose as you grow older a little bit and you understand the world, there was some, I wanted to keep the business going, and it was a successful business. And there was the weight of history, I suppose, a little bit. It was a good decision. It's a lovely business, a lovely community. And unlike Di's, you know, it was sort of pre-packed for me, ready to go, functioning. I'd already been trading for 100 and more years when I came along. So I've tried not to break it.
Yeah, I don't, is that more pressure though? Because if you're the one that runs it into the ground after 130 years or whatever, then that's not a legacy that you want to leave behind.
I suppose so. I think every Walker, so I'm the fifth generation of Walker, every Walker's really taken their own sort of approach to retail. I've been bringing in more ladies' fashions. My father did more linens and cookshop and that sort of thing, homewares. And his sort of uncle and father before that were more into curtains and other things and dress fabrics. And you know, times and fashions have changed a lot. So every generation is going to bring a different element to it.
Di, having been married for a few years, I understand the pressure that being married brings with it. And sometimes you want a bit of time alone. Not me. I can't spend enough time around my wife and my child, obviously. But some people may feel a little bit claustrophobic. What's it been like for your relationship being married to your business partner?
Undoubtedly a very positive thing.
Right.
Undoubtedly, because we are both living a dream that we had, not necessarily with this specific business or the specific nature of this business, but... We'd always wanted something together that was a bit more of a lifestyle business. So in that respect, we're living the dream together. And Whilst we do bicker occasionally, actually, it's a very strong partnership. He has certain tasks and certain responsibilities that he does. I have certain tasks and responsibility that I have. And because it's not a long-term family business like Sam's is, we're actually creating our baby.
Yeah.
And that's quite a different thing. So our children, we've got two children, both grown up now, James and Rebecca, and they now have their own children. It was never something that they were ever expected or required or groomed for taking over in any way. So any interest that they take in it now is, it's flattering and it's good, but they very much have set their own lives up and we set our own lives up. And there are probably more compromise with them because us getting away from a young business to go and see our family is a challenge for us. There's a degree of losing our sense of personal individuality and identity. We have become the business rather than I used to be a very good squash player. Simon used to have a big group of friends elsewhere where he used to socialise. And actually that has gone and is a bit of an expense of what we've done. But we're gradually now, as the business matures, being able to find a little bit more time to spend the important things in life, like family and our own time and enjoying ourselves outside the business.
Neil, what do your members tell you about that? Because we've heard glowing testimonies there from both of how helpful it is to be part of this as part of the family unit. But I dare say some of your members don't necessarily have always the most positive experiences. And I just wonder how they overcome that and overcome the stresses of working with loved ones.
Before we go into that, I just say it's great to hear Sam and Di's stories. I think I love hearing these family business stories, but I'm feeling very left out because they got a theme tune with the introduction. and I'm not sure what our theme tune would be.
I know, it'd be quite a niche show, that, wouldn't it? I'll tell you what we can do. We can try and get the Succession theme tune. How about
there
that?
There we are, do
because
that. There
that's a great piece of music in its own right, but we'll play that for you before the end.
Thank you. That'll be our new signature theme tune. I think, the reality of working in a family business has huge rewards, but also can be very difficult. And when we work with family businesses, kind of there are three big themes that run through everything we do. One is around succession. Another is around the family business governance. And the third is family business dynamics. So in a kind of corporate world, you might be talking about company politics. The reality is in a family business, you're talking about relationships with the people you are related to by blood or related to through marriage, et cetera. So it is a very different dynamic. And I think for family businesses, equally, an added complexity is not just those relationships, but the investment and time you have in those relationships. So in a corporate world, you've got colleagues and they can come and go. In a family, you've got family for life. And so when it comes to working through challenges in the family business, I think it takes a different mindset and a different approach to making sure that you can work through and find solutions that work for everybody. So I think it's a very different level of complexity that family businesses need to think about.
I guess that extra level can add that extra stress. But also, I'm guessing there's the other side where the emotional support is sort of ready-made if you get on with your loved ones.
Not everyone gets on with their loved ones all of the time.
No, of course not.
But I think it's true. I know you do with your wife, Johnny, but that's a different story.
I've never had a crossword ever.
No, never, I'm sure. But I think there are huge rewards and upsides because you've got a network there that if things are going well, offer a level of support that you arguably wouldn't get in other forms of business ownership, working in a PLC or a private equity backed businesses. So you've got that network there, which can be incredibly supportive. But equally, when things go wrong, actually, it can be even more complicated because you can't just necessarily run away. Mm. They are your family and you might be having disagreements in the workplace. But actually, at the weekend, you're at the kitchen table or the dining room table and, those issues are still there. So it definitely adds a layer of difficulty when things aren't going well. But when things are going well, a fantastic support network.
And I'm interested in hierarchy, Sam, because when you took over running it just over 10 years ago, wasn't it? Your dad was obviously running it, and he stayed on within the company, didn't he, until a couple of years ago. So did that mean that you were his boss?
Well, the first question I had to answer was I going to be called Mr. Sam or Mr. Walker? yes, because obviously there was quite a few Walkers over the years. We all had different names. No, I started from the shop floor, really, and worked on the linens department for my first few years, cut my teeth on the tea towels and the duvets and that sort of thing. But there was a sort of transition point, and my dad was very graceful about it, and there was never a problem, really. We were pretty good at chatting, probably too good. I mean, that's really, from the previous points, one of the elements that perhaps I believe in is a sort of human element to it. And, you know, the strength of the business in our case is the chats around the dinner table and the story that never gets dropped. And, you know, in a world of failing retail business and shops going bankrupt and stock markets breaking in half and AI and so on, a real human business, that's what family business conjures up for me, is the sort of human element of a group of people devoting time and energy.
Doesn't it get overwhelming though, particularly when it is such a difficult market like what you're doing? Non-stop talking about it, non-stop thinking about it, not really having that off switch, which everybody needs to be healthy in a professional sense.
Yeah, it is definitely an obsession. But I mean, realistically, anybody who started or run a business knows that they're all consuming and dominate, you know, family or otherwise, business is all consuming. And those are the best businesses, really. The nice thing about family business is if I've got to dart off to a meeting, I've got that shorthand with my dad and say, can you look after the kids for 2 hours? Because I've got this important thing.
He doesn't make you put in leave requests then or anything like that.
No, exactly.
And Di, dare I ask, who's the boss in your business? Is it a joint enterprise, or do you, by the nature of business, have to have somebody that is in charge at some point?
No, I don't think we do. I think we're perceived as a couple. And if there's a degree of diplomacy here, if anybody asks me who's the boss, I say Simon. And if anyone asks Simon who's the boss, he daren't say anything other than Di. So we do different things. He has a different style. There's a standing joke that if he disappears, he's the Scarlet Pimpernel. And that's because he needs his space sometimes just to go and do what he needs to do. We've got a very long station platform and a bird hide right down at the bottom of it. So if you need a few minutes time out, you can go and disappear down there. But in reality, it works really well. As I say, there's the odd bit of bickering. We have a fabulous team on at the station, and they're used to us and all our little quirks and ways. Yeah. And I would say we have not just a responsibility to our own families, but the burden is the responsibility to them. And it's not something that we have ever really appreciated, is the burden of everybody else's finances depend on us now. Their family relationships depend on the success of our business. That's as important for our team and the people who work with us as it is to our own families. And getting those balances right between time for ourselves, them having time for themselves, the finance all working, that's the biggest burden, that we have responsibilities to other people now.
And Neil, just when it comes to responsibilities, finance obviously is something that any business thinks about all the time, but especially family businesses. Are you optimistic in terms of obviously the new government? We have a budget on the way, which hasn't exactly been talked up. A lot of gloomy chat recently. What are your members saying to you?
I mean, we've been speaking to our members quite closely about this. And obviously in the lead up to the election, the new government kept their cards pretty close to their chest about their plans, and they had the margin and the polls to be able to do that. After getting into power, you know, they've obviously been in this listening mode to business, and there's been, you know, talk from the Chancellor about the $22 billion that needs to be found. There is growing concern about what is going to be in the budget on October the 30th. And obviously, we're all expecting taxes to rise. The one thing that is absolutely keeping family businesses awake at night is around a policy called business property relief. It was actually set up in the 70s under the Labour government, which is a policy that allows family businesses to pass on ownership of the business without punitive taxes, which other models of business ownership aren't exposed to, and it also allows family businesses to do what they do best, which is plan for the long term, invest in people, invest in skills, innovate in products and services, etc., and think about the next generation. Now, that policy is not well known. It's not well known primarily because it's not talked about, and it's not talked about because it works. It's something which is now probably under review. If there are changes to that, that will have a very material impact for family businesses, because it is sometimes misconstrued as being a tax on the individual or a loophole for wealthy individuals, when actually it's a tax on the business. And if there are changes to that, it means that those businesses will need to either withhold capital that would be used for investment, or potentially sell parts of the business or close down. Right. So we're really concerned about BPR. And changes to that in the budget.
Listen, there is loads of stuff we could get into, but time is beating us, I'm afraid. But I just wanted to wrap up with 30 seconds with each of you, if I could. Sam, I'm going to ask you first, very briefly, what's the best thing about being part of a family business?
I'd have to say the anecdotes that come in from the community in Weston, and I've just got to bring up one, which is I had a lady stop me the other day and say, do you know, I quite fancied your great uncle, actually. he drove a sports car in the 60s. It was very dashing. You know, I get there every day. People think they can talk to me about these things.
I'm sure people will be saying the same thing about you, the next generation, Sam. And Di, in 30 seconds, if I could, best thing about being part of a family business?
I think it is being proud, really proud of something that we've built, that we're doing, that we're delivering, that we're achieving.
Fantastic stuff. It's great. Listen, Di, when I'm in the Lake District next, I'm going to pop across for an afternoon tea because it looks incredible. And Sam, I'm back in Weston in a couple of weeks and I need some new bed linen. So I'm going to come and see you for that as well. Great to talk to you both. Thank you so much. It's been lovely. And Neil as well, this one's for you. There we go. Just to keep you happy, okay?
Thank you.
All right, there we go. Di Parhams, Sam Walker and Neil Davey for this evening's group chat. 29 minutes to midnight now.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as the coming storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now, today on 5 Live Drive, you might have heard the story of a man who survived an attack by a hippopotamus. Roland Cherry and his wife Shirley had just set off on a boat down the Zambezi River in Zambia on the holiday of a lifetime when they were attacked from below, throwing them into the water. We're going to go into quite a lot of depth now about what happened and the aftermath of that with the two people who are at the heart of this story, because I'm delighted to say that both Shirley and Roland join me in the studio here on 5 Live. Hello, how are you both?
Well, it's great to be here.
It's
great to be anywhere.
Well, yeah.
And I'm here too, and I'm very grateful to be here too.
I think I already know the way this interview's going to go. I don't know if there's... It's a loaded question, how are you? Because I usually just expect, yeah, I'm fine and, you know, we get on with things. But how are you? I guess when somebody asks you that question now, Roland, has a different meaning to it, considering what's happened to you over the past few months.
It does. It's beyond just a polite inquiry. So people are genuinely interested to see how my recovery is going. And it is going remarkably well. I mean, my wounds have healed up fantastically well. And it's really a question of getting my muscles and my ligaments, with good physio back in good shape. Yeah. My right thigh was very badly chewed up. So I'm having a lot of physio on that and the knee's quite sore. But, you know, all things considered, remarkably well. And, I'm out to walking the dogs and walking a reasonable distance. Not quite as far as I used to, but hopefully that fitness will come back in time.
So we're going to talk about what happened. It just so happens that it was 3 months to the day that happened.
Yeah, this morning, 3 months ago.
Goodness me. Before we talk about the event itself then, just set the scene. So take us back to June. You were travelling around Tanzania. This was the trip of a lifetime. Shirley, this been a long time in the making?
Well, actually, we do... have been doing a fair amount of travel, and Roland is a holiday planner.
Right.
So I generally pack my bags at the fairly last minute and then get a surprise when we get wherever we're going to go. But actually, back in the day, I had an aunt who said, your life with Roland will never be dull, and she never said a truer word.
It turned out to be very profound.
It did.
Absolutely. So you're travelling around. Tanzania, a place you'd been before or always wanted to go?
So it wasn't Tanzania, it was Southern Africa.
Sorry, Zambia. I've said Tanzania, it's Zambia. Yeah.
So we flew to Johannesburg, right. And it was the start of what was a planned five-week camping safari. And we were going to wiggle our way up through Botswana, through the Okavango Delta, and to the Marami and the Savuti, and end up on the Chobe River at the top end of Botswana, where it abuts on the Caprivi Strip onto Namibia, and then follow the Chobe where it flows into the Zambezi, and then down to Livingstone and the Victoria Falls. And that was going to be the end, well, it was the end of our first 2 weeks on the trip. And we had 4 days at the Victoria Falls. We wanted to go in June because the falls would be very full. You get the full curtain because we've been before at Christmas time, and actually the flow's only about 35%. We probably had 75, 80% of flow. So you got the full curtain effect. So it was wonderful. And that was part of the motivation for the timing of the trip. And the second part of the trip, the second three-week leg, was to go up through Zambia from Livingstone to this canoe safari on the Kafue and the Zambezi River, and then head up through the South Luanga National Park, and then up into Malawi, Lake Malawi, back across Mozambique and down the Indian Ocean coast of Mozambique, and then back into South Africa through Kruger. So that was the second 3 week, but we didn't get very far. So
yeah,
beginning of day four on the second leg was when we fatefully left that that camp on the Kafue River. Early doors, 8:15 or thereabouts, and we'd literally gone 100 metres, 150 metres, so 5 minutes or so from the camp when the incident happened.
Right. Had you seen any hippos up to this point, or had any run-ins with them at all?
Not run-ins as such, but we had seen them from a respectful distance.
Yeah.
In Botswana, but not on that morning, had we?
On the morning, no.
I've had the pleasure of going on safari and going to Tanzania and going to Kenya, and one of the first things they tell you is watch out for the hippos. And in the camps at night, they say you have to come and get somebody to escort you because the hippos are, you know, running wild, and they are very, very dangerous animals. When you were on and near the river, though, did you have that in the back of your mind at all? Or was it just something that people tell you, you take on board and you sort of get on with your trip?
Well, it's a fundamental question, isn't it, really? We did see a hippo the night before wandering through the camp on the riverbank. And the camp personnel said, oh, yes, yeah, we see that hippo quite frequently. We even nickname it the lawnmower because it comes and eats the grass in the campsite.
Right.
Thinking, really? And then there was somebody shooing it around with a torch, I seem to remember, which the thought was rather unusual. But
it all looked very benign at that stage, you know, and you don't really... it's bizarre, isn't it? Because they are very dangerous animals, but they don't necessarily appear that way to you.
No, these big lumbering creatures that sort of just waddle around, and it's only really when you see them open their mouth and yawn or go for something that you think, my goodness me, that is a set of teeth that they have on them. But you never expect to get near them, Roland, and you got very, very near to them. So take me to that morning, that day, then you're on the river. The events start to unfold. What happens?
So we'd literally left the camp sort of 5 minutes or so before, and we'd had a safety briefing, and they said, look, in the unlikely event that a hippo does attack, it will attack the canoes because they always go for the biggest sort of item in the water, in their territory. And we thought, fair enough, that makes sense. And the advice was, look, if you are turfed out of the canoe, you know, swim for the bank as fast as you possibly can. And so we'd taken that on board. We aren't quite expecting to have to do something about that within 5 minutes, which is what actually happened. So when the impact did happen and it came up, and I should say at this point that I never saw the hippo. Shirley did. letter, but I didn't see it, and I wasn't conscious. Even though I was in its mouth, I must have been comatose, or my poor brain had gone into shutdown mode or something, because I never consciously saw the hippo. I felt it. Mm. So when I was turfed out of the canoe, the side of the canoe smashed into my shoulder.
So before we get to that, so something hit the what canoe underneath? Well,
yes.
We know what hit it. Obviously, yes. the hippo had hit it underneath.
Yeah.
Who else was in the boat?
Just Shirley and I.
Just you two. Yeah. Right, yeah, okay.
They're two-man kayaks, and there was five. There was the guides in front of us, and then there were three other canoes behind us, all two-man kayaks.
So the canoe is upended. Were you, I mean, it will have happened in a matter of seconds, Shirley, but were you thinking, my goodness, this is a hippo? Were you thinking we'd hit a rock? What was going through your mind at that point?
It's bizarre because there was a noise. There was an almighty bang, a terrific noise, and it's like a car crash, really. So, as you said, the hippo came directly underneath us, and it takes a while to process what's going on. So, you know, it takes a couple of seconds to realise, my God, I'm in the water. And you think, what on earth is in the water with me? Yeah. And then people around were saying, you've got to swim, you've got to swim. So that's what I did, you know. But you have to sort of persuade yourself to move rather than be terrified and not do anything. So that was the scariest bit, really.
The problem is you couldn't swim, Roland, because... No. You dislocated your shoulder. Presumably it was hitting it on the canoe or something had hit it when you got turfed down.
When the hippo struck the canoe from underneath, it must have pivoted slightly in the water because the side of the canoe must have smashed into my shoulder.
Right.
And in the process of being ejected out of the canoe, my shoulder dislocated. And probably it went back in when I hit the water. Because we now know how badly ruptured the tendons were, and only much later. But it, boy, did it sting, you know, and I was not in a position to use my right arm. So I remember surfacing going, oh, dear, and I just kind of realised that I was in big trouble because my right arm was next to useless, and you usually need two arms to swim. So I thought, well, I'll have a go at doing a sort of a one-armed breaststroke, which is never going to be very successful. And sure enough, it wasn't. So, and moments later, I remember the feeling of something coming to grab me and then drag me down. And I remember thinking, oh, no, this is not what I had planned. This is not how I wanted to die. I thought, I've got too much to do. There's too much of life left. I've got things I want to do. I'm not ready to die. And I thought this would be it. Whether I felt I was going to get chomped up or whether I was just going to drown, I wasn't sure. But I was dragged down to the bottom of the river. And then the hippo let me go. And I don't know quite what I was thinking at the time, but I remember my life vest started taking me back up to the surface. And then I perversely started counting. And I sort of got to 7, 8, 9, 10. Counting the seconds, I thought, that's actually quite deep, isn't it? Anyway, I got to the surface and took a huge gulp of air. And then the timing's a bit murky. This must have been moments, really.
Sure.
And then I think the hippo came up. And then one of our Australian colleagues, Amy, was in the canoe behind, or two canoes behind. She got grandstand view of this hippo attack. And her extremely vivid description of what actually happened and describing me and my limp form horizontal in the jaws of the hippo. And it was just yards in front of her. She was traumatised, poor girl. But it's only that I know from Amy's description what actually happened. But then it sort of grabbed me and then threw me out of the water like a rag doll towards the bank.
I mean, that you haven't had a lot of luck at this point, but that was one of the small bits of luck by the sound of it, is that it threw you towards the bank and not further into the middle of the river.
I think that was the first piece of luck, definitely, because had I gone towards the middle of the river, I think, A, I wasn't in a position to swim. Whether the rescue boat could have reached me, I don't know, but the danger was that I was easier to chomp up there.
You're also being very British about this as well in the way that you're describing this. The terror, though, Shirley, when you realised you're safe, that's great, OK, but then presumably you are watching this as well and you see him disappear underneath, do you? Do you remember any of this?
Well, I was probably still swimming at that point, but when I got to the bank, I did look around for him and he was nowhere to be seen.
Right.
Oh, my God, where is he? Where is he? So I did start yelling at the top of my voice at that time, at that point. Where is my husband? Where is my darling husband? I want my husband. And then I actually saw him break the surface of the water. But then I didn't have a clear visual on it because I was tucked to the side of the bank, and actually the canoe behind us had also been capsized, but they didn't get attacked in the same way. But they were sort of shielding me, I think almost shielding me from what was going on, to be fair with you. But then I did have a concept that he was thrown, but I didn't have a clear sight of it. Probably very fortunately, to be honest.
You've suffered some terrible injuries. And I think the first apart from the shoulder, you saw your leg, which presumably was where the hippo had grabbed you and pulled you underneath, was it?
It's, whether it was in the first attack or the second attack, I'm not sure, but it's evident that the tusk went up my thigh and scraped the tibia in the process. And in one of the rather gruesome photographs that the plastic surgeon took in South Africa, she's got a surgical instrument that she's inserted in the wound, the hole that the tusk created in my thigh. So from mid thigh all the way up to almost up to the up to my hip joint here, must have been 6 or 7 inches. I can tell you what she said, but it was. I was, you know, it was remarkable, really, that level of injury didn't actually create bigger problems, you know, with vital organs and things. Yeah. And there was no major artery damage or anything. But I mean, it was just a terrible mess. But as the surgeons rather euphemistically said, you know, Mr. Cherry, it's superficial damage. I thought, well, you may think it's superficial. I think it's rather deep, personally. But
I think he actually saw scratches on the bone from the tusk.
Yes, she did. Yes, it was. Yes, she was. Dr. Venter, who was in her late 30s, early 40s, a very glamorous plastic surgeon.
Tall, blonde, blonde hair.
Yeah, she made quite an impression on me, really. she came out with the immortal words when I was after the first, what's called the debridement, which is where they open up all the wounds, clean them out, and then attach all sorts of vacuum drains to them. So I had 4 vacuum drains coming out of the key wounds.
Wow.
But the afternoon after she'd done the first operation in Johannesburg, and she came out with the immortal words. She said, Mr. Cherry, she said, somebody upstairs doesn't think your time on this earth is finished just yet. Wow. And I looked at her and said, what do you mean? She said, well, put it this way. You weren't lucky once. You weren't lucky twice. You were lucky 3 times. And she said, if each of those wounds in your right thigh, your left thigh and your lower abdomen had been 4 or 5 mil deeper, you would have lost one or both of your legs, and the wound in your abdomen, had it gone into your gut rather than your love handle. She didn't use that expression, fortunately, because she's far too polite. But then that's really serious.
Goodness.
Because
man,
if it goes into your gut, you either bleed to death. And if you don't bleed to death, then it's very difficult to control the infection. Because she pointed out hippos don't clean their teeth.
I was going to say, they don't strike me as having great personal hygiene.
No, that's not a priority, I think, if you're a hippo.
You've said about blanking out whether that was actually you lost consciousness or it's the body's self-defence mechanism. Do you remember any of it or any sense of pain during the event itself?
I don't remember a huge amount of pain, apart from the shoulder, which really did smart a bit when I landed in the water. That was very, very painful, and I did use some colourful language, which is not appropriate for 5 Live, so I won't use that.
You'd be forgiven. I mean, considering that you've just been attacked by a hippo, the odd bit of Anglo-Saxon language, I think, is forgiven.
Do you think the licence payer would agree with all that? That's great. That's very understanding of them. So, I wasn't. I mean, I when I was in the minibus being taken to the hospital, and when they got me ashore on the motorboat, then they got me across these 3 sort of seats in a minibus to take me to the Chirundu to supposedly meet up with Air Ambulance, but they weren't there. So we went to the little mission hospital, which the people who saved my bacon. But I do remember that journey, that half an hour, 35 minutes, was rather testing. because it was, and I remember thinking, I'm in bad shape here. I don't remember excessive pain. I do remember thinking, I've got a lot of things wrong with me here, and that's can take. And I also remember thinking, I must stay awake. I must stay compos mentis.
But it must have been like a dream to think it's a. You knew it was a hippo at that point.
Oh yes.
To think a hippo was has nearly killed me at this point and has really gone for me and done a number on me. A hippo, that must have been. I mean, you must have thought you were in some sort of dream when it was happening. In the
well, I'll tell you about the dream in a bit, because there was a proper dream coming up after the first. And Shirley will give you some of the things
operation for the operations the hospital. Yeah.
But it was less of a dream. I think, if I'm honest, I wasn't aware how badly injured I was. I didn't know whether I had really serious injuries and that I was hanging on for grim for life, really, because I just felt that I needed to stay conscious, because I felt if I did sort of nod off to sleep, that might be the last time I did that. So I thought, I've got to fight this and stay with it. So I did, and I had great support from Shirley and from the fellow travellers, who were just fantastic, you know, really encouraging and, you know, saying, don't worry, you know, we're on the way to hospital, you're going to be okay, yeah. It's all good. And then, yeah, then we got to the hospital and then they did their stuff.
How were you coping at this moment, Shirley? Were you in kind of fight or flight mode? Which one did you go into?
I was in the fight mode.
Yeah, I thought I could tell you would be.
I knew, you know, I had been fortunate. I hadn't been affected. I just had to be there for him. So I just went into wingman mode, really. So that was the least I could do, because had the hippo grabbed me, you can see our height disparity here. I'm vertically challenged, 5'1¾". That if he'd grabbed me, I probably wouldn't be here today. And also there were a couple of 19-year-old girls. I mean, equally, if the hippo had gone for their canoes, equally, it could have been absolutely fatal.
Yeah.
In fact, Amy, who wrote this very well-written account, she was convinced there were 4 fatalities that morning.
Yeah, she was traumatised by it, actually. And I think, as I said earlier, I think it's a blessing that I didn't come face-to-face to the hippo, that it dragged me from below. And then for whatever reason, I wasn't compos mentis, and perhaps I had passed out when I was in the jaws of the hippo, because I wasn't conscious of that. And I wasn't conscious of being thrown. I just remember perhaps I did come round, you know, I was sitting in the shallow water. But
it's a strange question, but how do you feel about the hippo?
I've been asked this question a few times, and my view is that you can't actually blame the hippo. We were in the hippo's natural environment. We were visiting her natural environment, and actually, having watched a BBC documentary on hippos only on Friday, which was quite
Saturday afternoon.
Saturday, was it? We realised that mother hippos are incredibly territorial and protective, even actually against other members of the hippo pod, let alone, you know, canoeists who turn up and
make splash around.
Around in their territory.
And we should point out, we either think or know she was protecting a calf or had recently given birth.
We found this out subsequently, that there was a mother with a calf.
Right.
And we also discovered after the event that, and they think it's the same hippo, had attacked local fishermen in a small boat.
Right.
One of the fishermen was badly chomped by the hippo, and his colleague was then killed by a crocodile.
Goodness me.
Having both been thrown in. And I think had we been aware that there'd been an attack in similar circumstances on the same stretch of river only 3 or 4 weeks previously, it was in mid-May, I think, it was literally not long before, then I think we would have taken a very different view, that if, you know, and if they're that notoriously protective, you should give them a very wide berth.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, this is all very easy after the event but some people knew before and chose not to share that information. So that was difficult.
Yeah. Tell me about the people that helped you, the medics that were there at the local hospital, because I know that you're raising money for them because of them saving your life, effectively.
Yes. We arrived there in this makeshift ambulance, aka a minibus, and because the air ambulance was not there where the rendezvous point was, so they said, take him straight to the hospital. Shirley probably best describe it because I was stretched out on a stretch at the time. So
yes, well, sandy covered floor outside, local people queuing up, waiting to be seen. It was a typical sort of African village hospital, and it was a bit chaotic, if you like, and only a few medical staff. But the ones were there, they just whisked Roland in, they took him for x-ray, and then they assessed the extent of his injuries. And then without any hesitation, without even bothering to find out insurance details or all the rest of it, they took him into theatre and cleared up his wound. So that's where another big stroke of luck.
Yeah, it would have been frustrating if they started to get you to dig out your E111 and your insurance at that point, wouldn't it?
And I think that's what coined this expression of the kindness of strangers, which is what was sort of our maxim that we've been, we've got a Just Giving page, Just Giving Roland Cherry, people can find that. And a lot of your listeners have already from our drive time discussion. They were remarkable. They did the best they could with what they had, and they did a remarkably good job. You know, there's photographs which you may or may not have seen of my poor thigh, which had been, as Shirley called it, trussed up like a rather bad Christmas turkey. But you know, they'd opened the wound up, and I was covered in iodine and stuff, wasn't I? And then the knee had been sewn up as well. So they'd sewn me up, you know, enough to be transported to South Africa.
Yeah.
And that intervention was absolutely key. But it was the fact that they treated me like one of their own, like just another citizen.
Mm.
The fact that I was, you know, a Western tourist and I'd turn up in their backyard. You know, they didn't have a lot, but whatever they had, they gave me. And they gave me their expertise and they had enough medical facilities around them to do what they needed to do. But we realised that we needed to give something back. You know, this is about repaying that kindness of strangers. And we feel passionate about it. And we did vow that, sitting in my hospital bed in Johannesburg, I said, when I get back, I'm going to do some fundraising talks and set up a fundraising Just Giving page because I want to give something back. And our ambition started fairly modestly. We thought we might get them one of those mobile ultrasound probes that you plug into an iPhone or an iPad, and they're fantastic for pregnant women or trauma victims, and you can use them out in the bush because they're all battery operated and great bits of kit, really. And, you know, and they were $2,000 or $3,000 or something like that. So that's how we kind of started. And then we were in touch with the hospital and said, look, you know, what are your hopes and aspirations? What do you need? And they sent us this document, which was their bid document, really, because they need a new ambulance. You know, they don't have an ambulance. They don't have a serviceable ambulance, so they can't move patients around. They can't collect them from RTAs or from any kind of trauma event, or move pregnant women with difficult situations into the hospital. They don't have that, so they're reliant on using some kind of third party vehicle, which is not ideal, to put it mildly. And we thought, well, perhaps we should have a bigger ambition here and see what we can do to help them realise that. Because as one of our friends who's done a lot of work in Africa said, you know, a serviceable 4x4 ambulance is a game changer for these little mission hospitals because they can get people there and, crucially, back to their homes again.
Yeah, and you are literally living proof the difference that having that service makes, aren't you?
Exactly, exactly.
Thank you so much for coming in. What an astonishing story. On the 3 month to the day anniversary as well. Final quick question to you. I take it you are still intending to travel. You don't seem like the kind of people that would be put off by this.
Shirley looks at me now. No, the world's a big place. There's a lot to see and do. And I wouldn't rule out going back to a lovely safari environment as well. I think if I was going to go anywhere near a river, I might be in a much, much bigger boat. Something like a battleship probably might be quite appropriate. I would encourage your listeners to go. I wouldn't want them to be put off. And not least, actually, because those tourist dollars are very important to these communities. It's very important for those people. A lot of livelihoods are driven from the tourist safari trade.
Mm.
But, you know, the, the local people we met, be it in Botswana, be it in Zambia, be it in Zimbabwe and South Africa, they were just lovely, weren't they? In the main, they were just so welcoming, so generous.
This is an it's an incredible place. And I'm glad that you made it back. That's the main thing. Thank you both so much to you for coming in. Good luck with the recovery. And good luck with the fundraising as well.
Yeah, and if your listeners are happy to contribute what they can to the Just Giving page, it's going to a fantastic cause.
Roland, Shirley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, I mean, that was just such a privilege to sit with that pair in the studio and talk to them before the show tonight. Absolutely amazing. And if you do want to find out more, if you just search Roland Cherry, Roland Cherry Just Giving, you'll find out more information there. Roland and his wife, Shirley Roland, who survived, and one of the few people to survive a hippo attack on the Zambezi. You're listening to Johnny on the Way. After midnight tonight, you can hear my conversation with the comedian Michael Spicer, the man made famous with his very funny skits, The Room Next Door. It's just genius, some of the stuff that he does. You can hear my conversation about him, his career, and his new Radio 4 series. That's coming up shortly.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Justine Green. The government has announced it's sending £5 million worth of humanitarian supplies to help civilians in Lebanon. The aid will be distributed by the United Nations. In New York, the organisation is holding an emergency meeting of its Security Council to discuss the situation in the Middle East. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned the situation in Lebanon is dire.
Hell is breaking loose in Lebanon. We should all be alarmed by the escalation. Lebanon is at the brink. Since October, nearly 200,000 people within Lebanon and over 60,000 from northern Israel have fled their homes. Many lives have been lost. All these must stop.
Network Rail says there's been a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations. Customers were directed to websites containing what the company says was inappropriate material before their Wi-Fi was suspended. An investigation is underway, but the BBC understands customer data wasn't compromised. The government has insisted its planned cuts to winter fuel payments for pensioners will go ahead after a motion to abandon the policy was passed at the Labour Party conference. Ministers say they're means testing the benefit to cover the hole in the finances left by the Conservatives. Our political correspondent Ian Watson has more details.
Labour's first conference as a government in 15 years should have been a celebration. But with some difficult decisions already taken, enthusiasm amongst the rank and file has been diluted by disquiet. Some of the big trade unions are unhappy with the decision to restrict winter fuel payments to the poorest pensioners. The leader of the Unite Union took the issue to the floor of Labour's conference and called for the decision to be reversed. The unions say that the Labour leadership could have taxed the wealthiest in society instead. The Labour conference did vote against the winter fuel cuts, but this is not binding. Unless there's a subsequent U-turn, the policy will go ahead.
Google is accusing Microsoft of anti-competitive practices. Google Cloud has filed a complaint with the European Commission, saying Microsoft is unfairly operating when it comes to cloud computing. Microsoft says it expects the legal action to fail.